Welcome to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides with Anna Staver, an hour where we share stories about Ohioans whose dedication, drive, and passion for their work or their hobbies can inspire us all. We begin with a 2,000-pound pumpkin and the man who transforms these monster-sized gourds into lions, tigers, even bears. Gus Squash Carver Smith Heisler is a professional pumpkin carver and food artist that has been carving gourds around the Buckeye State for more than 20 years. Gus, welcome to All Sides.
Oh my, and that's quite the introduction. Thank you.
Well, we'll get to the bear joke in a minute, but I want to start with the obvious question. How did you get into carving 2,000-pound pumpkins?
It actually started, I was a competitive grower, and I was growing giant pumpkins. We were at the Indiana State Fair in the middle of August, and I was cutting seeds out of a pumpkin with a giant knife. And I said, they're pumpkins. Someone should carve one. And they said, well, you have the knife. Go ahead. And that began a career.
Oh, my goodness. Were you always into drawing or other artistic pursuits, or was this just a newfound hobby in that moment?
A little bit of both. So, yeah, I used to do drawing and ink and colored pencil and stuff through college. Never really took anything course-wise, but just enjoyed playing with it. As a matter of fact, that's why I became an engineer, is because of my drafting skills and drawing skills. And then, like I said, the pumpkin carving, I never really did as a kid other than, you know, just the eyes and nose and mouth. But then I started sculpting them, and it, like I said, it just went from there.
Yeah, you graduated from Ohio State University with a degree in civil engineering. And I wonder, how do you think that education influences your designs?
Well, always, Brutus Buckeye is always a good subject.
But, well, that's true.
But I will say that the engineering part of it certainly has helped me when I'm cutting out sides, and people are asking how I decide how to cut things out and how do I make it stand up. And that engineering degree actually helps, you know, support things and keep things the right way. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like sculpture. There's a lot of thinking about structure and weight bearing and load bearing and like how far can you carve before the whole thing collapses.
Yeah, certainly, especially when you're working with a 2,000-pound gourd, you know, that's there's a lot of weight sitting there, and you got to make sure it's supported.
I do want to know, how does one grow a 2,000-pound pumpkin? Because it's not just like, you just don't grow one casually in your backyard.
No, they're very specific. They're Atlantic giants. They're all technically a squash, but don't tell the people in Circleville. They have a soft stem, so they're giant squash, but they turn orange. And there's a lot of genetics that goes into it. There's soil management, there's pest management and everything, but then lots and lots and lots of water. When I was growing, I was putting 50 gallons of water per plant per day.
Oh my goodness. That is a lot of water. You also can't move giant pumpkins very easily given their weight. Do you carve them on the ground, or do you have a system for lifting them up, or how, you know, you just, they're kind of, they just are where they are because of their weight.
Certainly. And up to about 500 to 800 pounds, we used to roll them on their side and put them on a tarp and try to get a bunch of people around them. Once they got bigger than that, you can't get enough people around them. So we've developed, the growers have developed a lifting ring with a strap around the bottom that we tie off. And it actually is very useful. And we've lifted almost the world record pumpkins right now are approaching 3,000 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, those rings are becoming more and more critical.
Do you carve them on site or do you transport them to wherever you're doing it?
A little bit of both. So I have to go to the, since I don't grow them anymore, I have to go and pick them up from the growers and then transport them to the site. I'll help them get set up. I'll put them on a stack of several pallets to get them up high enough so they're easy to carve. But I'm the band. I'm the live entertainment. I love carving on site, interacting with the crowd. People will come in and see what I'm doing and then come back and check on me later. I love interacting.
How long does it take to carve one?
That's depending on the size and complexity. I've had usually a 500 to 800 pound pumpkin I can carve in a single day. Once you get over that 1,000-pound mark, you can carve one in a day, but typically 2 days is a better time frame for that.
What kind of tools do you use for this? What is in your pumpkin carving kit? Because it's not the one we buy at like the grocery store.
So I tell people all the time that the anything sharp, really. My main carving tool is a fillet knife. I love using that because it's very thin and flexible. Once I get down to the shape that I want, I'll use a lot of clay sculpting tools. But I also have sharpened spoons and chisels and just a little bit of everything, custom made tools also.
That makes sense. A lot of like sculptors and pottery artists will custom make a little tool for whatever it is that they do specifically.
Absolutely.
You know, we had a show just the other day that Ohio has been struggling with a drought, particularly in the southeastern part of the state. What impact do you think that's going to have? I mean, we talk about, you know, the giant pumpkins, the Circleville Pumpkin Show. Like, how is it impacting the growers that you know?
Yeah, we've already seen the impact. We've had a lot of growers who don't have a ready supply of water, and a lot of them have lost almost everything, or their weights are way down. The general pumpkin population, a lot of those are a lot lighter, a lot thinner and lighter than normal. So you'll see a lot of these pumpkin farmers, the pumpkin farms, importing pumpkins from other states who had better years.
Oh my goodness, that's crazy. You go to the local pumpkin patch and it's pumpkins from a totally different state.
Yeah. I my understanding is Indiana had a better year than we had. So you'll probably see some. They're another big state for growing pumpkins. But yeah, especially the Southeast, I know a lot of growers down there who've lost everything, unfortunately.
Oh my gosh, that's terrible. So what happens to all the pumpkin guts? Like, what happens to all this stuff when you're done? Where do you get rid of a 2,000-pound pumpkin?
Wherever you can. two things on that. Number one is when I carve them on site, I try not to get into the middle. I try to just sculpt on the surface of it. Getting in the middle of a giant pumpkin is a very messy thing. There's a lot in there. So
you're not doing the jack-o'-lantern. We're not putting candles inside these.
Right. Correct. I do carve them that way every once in a while. But the other side of that is the seeds. The growers, because these are Atlantic giants, they're very interested in the genetics of their seeds. They want to get their seeds back. So what we'll do is we'll go in there and we'll collect all the seeds. And there could be 1,000 seeds or more inside one of those giant pumpkins. They're about the size of a quarter. And then we'll send those back to the grower. And then the rest of the pumpkin, usually the site doesn't have a way of disposing them. So I have to go back and pick those up. And my yard is full of a bunch of rotting pumpkins.
You must have very fertile soil.
I do. Very, very fertile.
Halloween is coming up. And so while I have you, I had to ask for some pumpkin carving tips for all of us out there getting ready to make our jack-o'-lanterns.
Absolutely. And these are tips I love to give both adults and kids. So for the children out there, and so the adults know, the clay sculpting tools, it's called a ribbon tool. They're sharp enough to go through the pumpkin and carve off the skin, but they're not generally sharp enough to cut a finger. So they're great for kids to just scrape away at the pumpkin and put their design on. For the adults, when you're carving out the pumpkin, my key is my hand that's holding the knife is never the one doing the carving. The other hand is pushing the knife or pulling the knife. I'm using my hand holding the knife just to aim the knife, to give it direction. The actual carving is done with the other hand. That way, in 20 years, knock on wood, I have never cut myself while carving. Now, that doesn't mean I haven't cut myself cleaning my knives or reaching into my tool bag or something like that, but not while carving.
So it's two hands on the knife.
Two hands on the knife at all times.
Oh, that's different. Do you find that gives you like more control? Because like part of the challenge is just getting it physically through the skin of the pumpkin.
Right. And that's why it's important to have a sharp knife as well. That's why I like the fillet knife. I have a sharpener in my toolkit that I sharpen that knife two or three times while I'm carving during the day. Keep it nice and sharp and it goes through pretty easily.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Goes through pretty easily means we'll go through your hand pretty easily, too.
Go through your hand, exactly. That's why I tell people always, if you're pushing that knife with your hand or pulling it, you're not going to cut yourself. If you're trying to use your other hand to help that, and then your hand gets in the way, then that's where you get into trouble.
How do you pick a design? How do you look at the pumpkin, and what kind of tips would you have for figuring out like what you can do given its shape?
So a general pumpkin, they're very often the same shape, and the stencils and stuff that they have out there are fantastic, especially for the beginner. So that's for the regular size pumpkins. For the larger pumpkins, they're never the same shape. They always have a bulge here or a crack there. So I have an idea going in what kind of theme I want to do. But once I have the pumpkin set up in its final spot, that's when I decide exactly what I'm going to do with that pumpkin. So it changes. People ask me all the time what I'm going to carve, and I'm like, I don't know until I set it up.
And when you mess up, when you make a mistake, how do you pivot?
Mistakes? What are
Your
those?
knife never slips. It
certainly.
never goes where you don't want it to.
Yeah, it happens on occasion. So the nice thing about the giant pumpkins is they're very forgiving. They have a lot of thick flesh. You start off very shallow and get the idea of what you want to do, and then you go deeper and create the shadow and create the sculpture. That way you're less likely to make a mistake. If you make a mistake in that shallow stage, you carve it all off and you just go a little bit deeper with it. So other times you just change the design. I had a farmer with a nice wide brimmed hat at one time, and then one swipe of the knife and now he's wearing a baseball cap. So
You just got to pivot.
yep.
You know, in preparing for this show, I learned that you don't actually like eating pumpkin. You're not a pumpkin person.
Well, pumpkin is okay. I like pumpkin pie. I enjoy the pumpkin spice latte. The squash is the one that's just not my cup of tea.
I am with you on that. I actually don't like pumpkin either at all, of any kind.
No,
I
not
know.
possible.
I know, I'm a no gourd of any. Well, I like zucchini, but that's it. So,
Zucchini are good too, yeah.
yeah, but those also can get giant if you accidentally forget about them in your garden. But
But if you just wait one day, they get too big, right?
do you
And they're
cut?
all related. So it's interesting. Most people don't realize all the relations between the fruits, the pumpkins, the squashes, the zucchinis, the cucumbers. They're all related.
Yeah, they're all in the same family.
Yep.
One of the fascinating things is you have gotten to travel all over the country. You've been on the Food Network. Can you tell us some of the places that you've carved at? Like, you've had a pretty amazing run as a giant pumpkin carver.
I've been very fortunate. Yes, I've carved pumpkins in, I think a last count was 16 different states. Carving in Las Vegas was very surreal. Carved at Bellagio in Las
Oh
Vegas,
my goodness.
and when people come by and see you in the morning, and then they come by later to see what you're doing in Las Vegas with everything to look at there, that was it still makes my hair stand on end that people did that. So that was one of the experiences. And then just recently, I was invited to go over to Japan to carve snow at the International Snow Festival in Sapporo, Japan. So I can call myself an international sculptor now.
Snow, that's going to be different. It's a whole different medium to work in.
Yeah, it is. I enjoy going into different media. The snow was very unique. It's a much larger canvas, obviously. We had a 10 foot by 10 foot by 10 foot block of snow, and it took us 4 days, a team of three of us. So working with a team and carving that down. But then I've also, aside from the pumpkins, I've gotten into cheese and fruits and vegetables and other stuff like that. And then I've even gotten into fiberglass sculpture, doing some stuff like that. So I continually expand and try different things and see what works.
You ever tried the butter cow?
Only during the pandemic, they had that competition, and I had to carve a butter cow, but I had to include Smokey Bear because Smokey Bear is a part of the fair as much as the cow. So I had both. It made out of butter.
You have a pretty long-standing relationship with Smokey the Bear.
I do. I do. I've worked for the Department of Natural Resources for over 30 years. And about 25 years ago, I had an opportunity to volunteer at the state fair with Smokey Bear. And I've been doing that ever since. I love Smokey Bear. I love his message. I love what he brings to the kids. And actually, even the adults coming back after years, it's like, Smokey remembers me. I love you, Smokey. So, yeah, Smokey Bear has been a long friend of mine.
And you've carved some Smokey Bear pumpkins.
I do. Smokey Bear and Jack Hanna are my two most popular people that I've carved. So I've carved Smokey Bear easily a half dozen times. Jack Hanna, similar. Otherwise, I try not to repeat designs at all. I try to carve something new every time. But those two just seem to keep coming back.
I have to ask, you have an orange cat at home. Is its name Pumpkin?
How do you know about my orange cat?
I am good at creeping on people for my job.
I guess. Yeah, actually, we just redid our floors in hardwood, and he matches the floors almost perfectly. He disappears in the floor. But yeah, I have an orange cat. I have an orange car. I have a green truck, so I could keep it in the theme. So yeah,
but his name is
orange
not Pumpkin.
Is a big part of my life.
So where do we find you online? You have a Instagram account, correct? Could you share how people can see your carvings?
I do. I have all the basic social media, Facebook, Instagram, X, TikTok. So there's a good place to go. Also squashcarver.com. So there's plenty of places for people to come out and find me. I do on Facebook, especially, I notify people when we have the events where we're going to be so people can come out and see me.
Is that also Squash Carver? Is that what you would search for on Facebook?
It Squash Carver on each one of them. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
That was Gus Smith-Eisler, the Squash Carver. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Anne.
Coming up, we're talking with CNN's Phil Mattingly about covering politics and growing up in Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Saver. If you watch CNN, then you've probably seen our next guest covering the day's top news stories. Born in Ottawa Hills outside of Toledo, Phil Mattingly is chief domestic correspondent for CNN. He previously co-anchored weekdays on CNN This Morning and is a proud alum of The Ohio State University. Phil, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So you attended Ohio State as an English major, playing baseball. Did you know going in that you wanted to work in journalism?
Just a quick clarification, playing baseball in terms of in the actual season itself is a tad bit of an overstep. I was on the team.
Okay.
Honestly, I knew that I loved to write. I had an amazing English teacher my junior year in high school, fell in love with writing, knew I wanted to write. I think it's fascinating to talk to kids who are in high school now because they actually have like pathways laid out and know exactly what they want to do. And I went to college to play baseball and to, I don't know, because that's what you were supposed to do. And I think I put together that like, oh, well, you could write and it's fun to talk to people and I'm generally curious. Reporting is a pretty great job description if those are the things you're into. I could not do extracurriculars. We weren't allowed to do extracurriculars by coach's mandate. So to be a journalism major at Ohio State, you had to be able to write for the Lantern, the student newspaper. Wasn't able to do that, so I chose English. And then once I was done with baseball, my last year at Ohio State, was able to go write for the Lantern.
Did you ever consider sports journalism? You know, you played baseball, you were into writing and talking to people. Yeah. It would feel like the natural segue.
You know what's funny? So I covered my job at the, or my assignment at the Lantern. I was a senior at Ohio State when I was done. I didn't play my last year. And I was tasked with covering the men's hockey team, which was awesome. And we had a really good team back then. I knew a lot of the guys because we all kind of hung out together. It's on like Friday nights instead. It's on weekends. Sports is on weekends and at night. And in college, that was particularly problematic, I found, given that we all kind of preferred to be on High Street. But it's also as I've gotten older, I've got four kids now. Like that's a tough life. I'm not saying being on the campaign trail is
like less roses tough, and butterflies. Yeah.
but the schedule is not super conducive to a social life, which back then I think mattered to me a lot. Also, I think sports for me is an escape. I love sports. I constantly have sports when my wife's not watching Bravo on in our house. And it's nice not to have to think about, you know, salary caps and what executives are thinking and all that type of stuff.
I gotcha. So how did you land in politics?
It's funny. I was a huge history buff growing up. My dad was in the military. And I like big time nonfiction biography type reader, still am today, was not like a politics obsessive. You know, the Cincinnati mayor, Aftab Perumal, was a year ahead of me at Ohio State. And I didn't know who he was, even though he was the student body president. If we were, he, when I was covering the White House, he was there for an event and we were talking outside the White House. And he was walking through like all the people that were really prominent at that time in Ohio State student government and Ohio State politics, many of whom have gone on. You would know them. You probably covered them at the Dispatch one way or another. And back then, I had no concept of any of it. I voted, but like I would be on a run in the middle of the Oval and be like, why are there all these people here? Oh, John Kerry is holding a rally today. So I wasn't like super keyed in. I went to grad school for journalism after Ohio State at Boston University. They had a program where you could come down to DC, come down here for a semester, and kind of serve as the DC correspondent for a New England newspaper. I had the Cape Cod Times, and I fell in love with Capitol Hill. You know, you get a press pass on Capitol Hill and you have complete access to 535 of the most powerful people in the world, and they will talk to you. And, you know, at that time I was covering the Massachusetts delegation, which was Teddy Kennedy, John Kerry, Barney Frank. So, you know, like
big names. Yeah.
Titans of that kind of era, of that period of time. But also I'd run into Pat Tiberi or Deb Price or John Boehner and all that type of stuff. And I loved it. I fell in love with the city, fell in love with politics, and everything kind of just went from there.
I want to talk about, so you ended up in television instead of print, which is like a whole conversation, I'm sure. But, you know, I worked for a television station in Denver for a while as a producer. And one of the hardest tasks I had when I first joined was take a 500-word web story that I had written and condense it down to 50 words for an anchor. And the first time they asked me to do it, I was like, it cannot be done. But it turns out it can be done. It's just not easy. So I want to say I have a real admiration for television journalists who can break down complex policy quickly, because it is hard. And I wanted to know, how do you approach those more wonky, those more dense topics, knowing that you've got 3 minutes, maybe four, if you're super lucky, to explain it?
You were like speaking to my soul right now. I mean, I didn't come, like, I was in print for years. You know, I started at Congressional Quarterly when I like begged for any job I could get in the Capitol Hill Press Corps, covering finance, went to Bloomberg after that, covering finance, and then the Obama White House. And didn't switch over to TV until probably 8 years into my career, which was purely because Bloomberg had a television station, which is kind of like CNBC on the business side. I would do live shots for them when I broke news in print, and they asked if I wanted to do TV full time. And I thought at the time, like, no. I didn't think, and this was wrong. I want to make very clear that my perception was wrong, but I thought TV guys were just rip and read type folks, right?
Like, oh, they I would did take too. My stories. I 100% did before I worked at the television station in Denver.
Totally. And it wasn't that like I didn't respect them. I didn't think they were talented. I just thought that they like took our stuff and read it on air or talked about it on air. And which, again, I want to stress is very much not the case.
Yeah.
But so like after some negotiation, where I was allowed to keep writing and keep doing print stuff, moved over. And then shortly after that, CNN called. CNN was really, I did some packaging stuff when I was at Bloomberg. So, you know, the kind of, as you know, the stories you see on television that are like video, not live shots. And like my first producer at Bloomberg, who actually works with me at CNN now, runs our national security team. I mean, he would just laugh when I would try and script because it was impossible for me. And the funny thing is I just got back. I was out for 10 days kind of through swing states for a project I'm working on right now. I was in Northeast Ohio for part of it. And I'm trying to write the first script. It's a 3-part series for TV. And then we've got 3 parts for digital video, and all of the writing is, and I'm doing digital print stories. All of the writing is different. The kind of core components of the story are the same, but writing them in ways that like you write I think the hardest thing for me was like learning, okay, write to the visual, write to the sound, write to what you've got. Like, your photogs are awesome. Use them. Like, they do really cool stuff. And meanwhile, you know, to your point, like on policy stuff, I'm like, let me explain the structural dynamics of risk pools when we're covering healthcare. And our producers are like, dude, come on, man. So long way of saying it's a process that I'm still in the process of trying to figure out. But it's awesome. Like it's very different, but it's really cool to be able to pull on all the different elements.
Yeah, visuals definitely help. In television, like, good graphics can go a long way to explaining things, particularly if you've got a bunch of numbers you want to show people. But, you know, I really loved how you broke down the importance of union voters in Michigan. It was a story you had last year. And it is, right? It is a complicated topic. But in under 3 minutes, you were like, this is this and this is this and why this is why the Michigan counts. And you had a active board that was doing a lot of your graphics. Yeah. But it's, I don't think people appreciate just how difficult that is.
You know, what's interesting is what I found with TV, and I would preface with everybody does what they do differently.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
There are people who, you know, like that specific story or that segment, like that wasn't scripted. That was, you have spent so much time reporting, working on the story, looking through the numbers that, like, what I learned fairly early on, at least for me, was, if it's something you've been reporting on, you know it. Trust yourself with it. And when, with that specifically, you know, you get the magic wall, which is my colleague John King, who's been a wonderful mentor of mine, is famous for kind of being the tip of the spear on what has now become, you know, Steve Kornacki's awesome as well. Everybody kind of has their own board on election nights. And JK kind of helped me get into that back in the 2018 midterms, was learning how to utilize, kind of like we were talking about graphics and visuals and all that type of stuff. Use the wall. Like, don't tell people what's happening. You have the visuals behind you. It's an extraordinary tool. How do you use the wall? And I think that is actually serves as my guide when I'm talking about that kind of stuff too, as like, all right, well, what are the counties? What are the poll numbers? What are the breakdowns that I think really get at the core of this? How can I show them to people? And then I use those as kind of the bullets that I want to hit throughout the live shot.
You've covered a lot of major moments in recent political history. The ousting of Kevin McCarthy, attempted repeals of Obamacare, the first years of the Biden administration, sanctions on Russia, the wars in Ukraine and Gaza. It's a lot. But I do want to ask you about one moment in particular, just because. So CNN anchor Wolf Blitzer had this viral moment when Biden announced he was dropping out of the race. Because an hour before news broke, Wolf had shared a photo of him enjoying a Wolf Spritzer cocktail. So I got to ask, where were you when you got the news that Sunday?
So here's the best part about this, to take people behind the scenes. You know, shortly after that started to go viral, I was sitting on set next to Wolf, right? Because we'd all rushed in. Anybody who's in town, and Wolf has like a teleportation system, right? Like, something absolutely massive happens on a day. You know, Wolf lives probably like a 35 minute drive out in the suburbs of DC, and somehow I think I'm flying into work and Wolf is already on air when I walk in like jeans and a t-shirt, and is like already made up and ready. And so we are sitting there as this is going viral, and it's like me, my colleague Jeff Zeleny, and a couple of University of Nebraska grad, Big Ten guy, and a couple of us just sitting on the panel during a commercial break. And like, I started getting text messages about the tweet as well. And we're asking Wolf about it. And Wolf, who is like one of the nicest man in the history of the world, to the greatest colleague you could ever imagine. And Wolf is just like so flatly like, well, it was a good drink. and I appreciated it and all that type of stuff. That was great. And like that was happening. It was like kind of breaking through the fourth wall as that was happening. I was in my basement. I had just sat down with a sandwich. My kids were out of town. So was my wife. So luckily I was alone. It's easier to extract myself from the house. And I saw I have Biden's tweets alerted. And I saw it. I clicked it. I read it. Literally sat down. We kind of had all expected it at some point. We're clearly moving in that direction, but you know, I covered him when he was in the Senate. I covered him when I was covering President Obama. I'd covered this the Biden administration from the very first day. January 20th was my first day, 2021 was my first day at the White House for the second time, and had been on every trip with him, had just been the chief White House correspondent. So, and it was kind of a holy blank moment. and then it was, I need to shave very quickly.
That's fair.
And drive into work as fast as I can. And so when I got into work, I think, you know, like Zeleny was in like shorts and a tie and a jacket. And I was like, all right, we gotta go.
Yeah, we knew we were going to do a show Monday morning. I was at my daughter is a competitive dancer, and I was at a dance practice, and I got the alert, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yes, very much like, all right, the stage has changed.
Yeah, because we were down in Dayton, so we drove back to Columbus, and she had to sit with me at work. I got her some snacks. I gave her an iPad, and I was like, you are going to hang here for like a couple of hours while we completely scrap and redo what we're doing for tomorrow.
Yeah, I love that moment in parenting. That moment in parenting where you're like, whatever you think about screen time or sugar or anything else, like
out
it does not matter. It's like whatever you want to watch, whatever you want to eat, if I can get my hands on it, you got it. You just sit in a corner quietly, please. I still love you, but please.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those strange moments. And like as a journalist where you're just like, well, you're coming with me on this ride and we're just going to make it work.
Yeah, but honestly, like I love those moments of our job where you don't know what's going to, and I say this knowing that like everything that's happened in the last 10 months, like we didn't know was going to happen. And so we're kind of living in this space permanently, but like the moments where huge news is breaking, where you're on air, and if I think the best people candidly acknowledge, like, I don't know what this means, or I don't have that information yet. I'm going to walk you through this as I learn it. I think it's actually really, one, it's invigorating, and like the intensity of it is the best part of the job. But two, I think there's a transparent element to it that shows people what we're doing and how we're doing it. And I think that that's where we historically are at our best as a network when there's breaking news. I think that's where we get to kind of show off the amazing talent we have across the board, wherever it's happening in any corner of the world. And so that's awesome to watch from a member of this team, even if I'm not involved in the story, to watch it happen live. But the other thing too is, I think at a moment where people don't really understand what we do, which in many cases we have a reason, or we're responsible for at least some of that, it's really cool for us to walk people through it and be honest with them. Like, we don't know what this is. We don't know what's happening. This is what we know now. We are trying to learn more information. We'll tell you when we learn more information. That stuff you're seeing online, we don't know if it's true. We're trying to confirm it. We're talking, like, that type of stuff, I think is, I think it's really cool.
Yeah. It gives you a lot of respect for anchors that have to go do it live on air. It's especially because as a journalist, I always said with print, it's, you know, breaking news is you drafting online in public, which is very scary. And for anchors, it's you literally drafting online in public in front of like tens of thousands, sometimes millions of viewers.
Yeah, we were I was filling in on for Dana Bash on Inside Politics a couple weeks ago. Week and a half, 2 weeks ago, I guess, when the shooting down in Georgia happened, and it happened like 10 minutes before the show. And
so the entire show was suddenly scrapped.
Yes. Yeah. And we had a great show. We had a great panel. The panel was already sitting with us. And you know, you just sit there and you take a moment and you're like, all right, like, here we go. And you're without a net, and you know, to your point, but that's where like our organization is awesome, because you know, we've got people on the ground there, we've got great producers, we have a great show team, so you've got kind of layers of help to kind of get through, like to get things cleared for it to be used on air, like goes through several check processes, which is good. But by the time it was over, you know, the hour like flew by, and then you're like, whoa. Okay, like that's heavy and a lot, but it's working with that team is really great.
So as an Ohioan, I wanted to ask, you know, Ohio's not a swing state anymore, but we've certainly been a big part of this election in ways I did not see coming. I mean, Senator J.D. Vance being added to the Republican ticket, we kind of knew that might happen, but Springfield, Ohio, is now the center of the immigration debate, which I will admit, I was not on my bingo card for 2024, but
You know, as an Ohioan, how do you look at stories that really center around our state like this?
I mean, it cuts a couple different ways. Like, on some level, Ohio moving in the direction politically that it has been terrible for me, not because I care about Republicans or Democrats, but because that was my reason to take free trips home back in 2016 or in 2018, right? Like, in 2016, you're like, oh, this is, I was covering the Trump campaign. And I was like, oh, this is great. I get to go back to Ohio and see my friends like every 2 weeks. And the last couple of cycles, it's been like, all right, maybe Ohio's off the map. The J.D. Vance pick was actually awesome. I was on the convention floor and somebody from the Ohio delegation like grabbed me and was like, hey, you might want to hang out near us tonight. Because we were all waiting. We knew he was kind of at least one or two, probably one. And, you know, so I'm sitting there with Mike DeWine, who I've interacted with in the past, John Husted, like the entire Ohio delegation, who, by the way, not super tight with J.D. Vance, not because they don't like each other, but because Senator Vance didn't come up through kind of Ohio politics, the Ohio system. So there's like a fascinating like disconnect there on some level. But so it was great. I got to hang out with Ohioans for like the entire first night of the convention. And like Mike DeWine learned about Vance being picked from my producer's phone, because we were sitting there with a camera because they had told me to hang out. And once Trump truthed it out, my producer was standing next to me and DeWine literally looks at me and he's like, I'm not going to go on air until I have it confirmed to me. Which, by the way,
totally
is
fair.
A veteran politician dealing with Trump kind of move that I deeply respected. And so my producer handed Governor DeWine his phone, and DeWine read it on Truth and then came on air with us. So that was great. And it was fun to be kind of in the mix with Ohio folks. Springfield is, I've kind of run out of, I don't think I've come up with the words to describe it. You know, when I was in junior high and high school, like every big baseball tournament, we'd play at Springfield. We played the state tournament regional games when I was in high school for baseball down in Springfield. I was probably down there 8-10 times a year for 10 years running. Not on my bingo card either. And I think that the issue that I have with it is, issue is probably not the right word. I think that this is, like many Ohio communities, it is very easily shorthanded, caricatured, minimized as a community because it's a town in Ohio, which I kind of always take personally. The actual issues themselves are so complex and so layered and have developed over time. And the people on whatever side they're on related to immigration or related to what's happened, the people are not the focus right now, because, you know, there's a video of one of the town halls a couple weeks ago, and you watch that and like, okay, that's a debate of people that are actually living this and are dealing with this. And there's a nuanced layer or version of events, none of which is reaching the day-to-day level that kind of we're all living in a national political coverage basis. And I've really had a hard time. It's not my story. It's not my assignment. We have a phenomenal colleague, Omar Jimenez, and his team have been down there doing really great stories. But like, this is the worst kind of story because simplification is dangerous. Mm. And yet simplification is the only way we seem to operate in this media moment, we as in a country. And so I've struggled with it because I know the town, I know people there. And I think while I'm not keyed into what's happening in Springfield every single day, it was not hard for me to quickly figure out what's happened over the course of the last 10 years and realize like, this is a lot more complicated than people are making it out to be. And where it has gone and the lies that have been told are unprofessional is the least harsh criticism you could give to it. Dangerous is probably the most.
That was Phil Mattingly, chief domestic correspondent for CNN and Ohio native. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the Ohio State researcher searching for a cure to long COVID. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I'm
Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Fascinating Ohio on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. COVID-19 may have moved from pandemic to endemic, but the struggle for those with long COVID, where symptoms can linger for weeks or even months, remain the same. And these symptoms can be debilitating. That's where Amal Amer comes in. She's a professor of microbial infection and immunity at Ohio State's College of Medicine and the principal investigator on a new study to look at how blocking a single molecule could protect against long COVID. Professor Amer, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
Let's start with the science. What is, I hope I say this correct, capsaicin 11, and why is it so important when it comes to COVID?
So caspase 11 is an enzyme, and it's present in all our cells. And this enzyme works only when needed. And we worked on caspase 11 for so many years in the context of bacterial infection.
Okay.
And that helped us understand a lot of its functions that were not known before. Then the pandemic came. And as a microbiologist, I have several people that are very enthusiastic in the lab, and we decided to go into SARS-CoV-2 and see what would be the function of caspase 11 in viral infection. But it wasn't a random choice. It's because we knew what caspase 11 can do in bacterial infection. We were almost confident that this molecule is responsible for a lot of the pathogenesis that happened during SARS-CoV-2 infection. And therefore, if it's not there, the animal model will be protected. And this is exactly what we did. We infected a normal animal model and another model that does not have this molecule. And we were very happy to find out that the second animal model is protected. The lung was protected from the severe infection, from the inflammation, from the tissue damage. And then recently we did also work on the brain, and we found out that also the pathology in the brain is much less in this model. And this is what started the whole story.
So you don't want this in your body. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And that's why it's a drug target.
Okay, so the idea is then, the theory, if I'm understanding, is if we can find people who have it and give them something to block it, we can prevent severe symptoms, potentially.
Absolutely, but we all have it. We all have caspase 11. It is expressed in a very small amount. However, when you get infected, usually with any infection, it goes up.
Okay.
So if we can find a way to stop it from going up, or even after it went up, it's an enzyme, to block its action, then we will save the body from many pathologies.
So not just COVID, potentially.
Absolutely. And that's what we found in some bacterial infections.
So this summer, Ohio State was awarded $15 million from the National Institutes of Health to fund this research. And it looks like it's going to be a five-year project. This is a long commitment.
Yeah, you would think it's a long commitment, but science doesn't go as fast as we think. Experiments take forever, and they have to be repeated. Then you do the experiments with the controls and the controls of the controls in order to make sure that what you find is really real. Then you have to apply that to human samples. So I would like to thank everybody, all the patients and non-patients who generously give us their blood samples to be able to understand is what we find in the mouse is also recapitulated in the human, which is extremely important. So 5 years seems like a long time, but in the science, timing is not that long.
And this research also has implications for Alzheimer's disease?
Yes, so because when we send the grant the first time, we had a very small portion focused on long COVID. And by the time the reviews came back, long COVID was a big thing, and many people were complaining of these diverse symptoms that doesn't even make sense at that time, and still till today. But then we realized, okay, we really need to focus on the brain. And then, because we are a lab where we work also on Alzheimer's disease, all the tools that I have in the lab for the brain in Alzheimer's disease, I applied them to the SARS-CoV-2 infected model. And we were able to get, of course, brain samples from the animal model, but also brain samples from biobanks that will help us understand what's going on in the brain as well.
That's so fascinating. I have to ask, how did you get into microbial research?
So by training, I was an MD. I practiced medicine a little bit, but there was always something missing. Like when you deal with patients, it's fascinating and rewarding, but you have these lingering questions, especially for those who don't respond. Okay, why this patient didn't respond? How about we try this? Maybe we try that. And then in the patient world, you cannot do that. You cannot try this or try that. And there were always questions nagging in my head. So I went back to school and I was married with two kids and I got a PhD. And then I came back. Now I know how to do research. You can use cells, cell lines, samples, animal models, and you can ask any question you want. And the fascinating thing about science, and I tell that to my students, you can wake up in the morning, have this idea, oh my God, what if this doing that? You go to the lab and you do it and you have an answer. Sometimes we're looking under the microscope and I tell myself, oh my God, we must be the first people to know that this is happening. But actually, then life taught me, okay, if you're smart, there are a lot of other smart people. And we end up finding many other labs are looking at it at the same time.
No, I love that. It's curiosity run wild.
Yes, it is. And it's very rewarding.
I would imagine. I also think it's quite a commitment to go through all the education and training to be a medical doctor there, and then be like, you know what I want? I want more education.
Yeah, but I have to say that my medical background helped me a lot.
I would think.
Not every scientist have to study medicine, but when your brain also has this medical background, you have the courage to go to venues that maybe if your specialty is focused on one thing, you can't just jump to another thing. So I worked for so many years on the lung, and then, you know, with the pathway I'm working on, it took me to the brain in the context of Alzheimer's disease. It didn't scare me because I know I have the background. What is the brain? How does it work? And then when SARS-CoV-2 came, I said, okay, let's go back to the lung and the brain and look at that another pathogen.
So what happens at the end of this? I've always kind of wondered. You've got this $15 million. You've got 5 years. Like, what will success look like to you at the end of this?
So first, I have to say that it's not me alone. I have a great group of people. And the fascinating thing about Ohio State is that you find all the expertise you're looking for. So the data we received from the early experiments and our paper was published in PNAS, that there is a lot of pathways are affected. I had two options. Either decide to do all on my own, and that will take forever, or collaborate with people that have the expertise and we go parallel, all of us together. And this is what the NIH like, that you work together and you achieve better things in a shorter period of time. So I decided to go to my collaborators. They're amazing, and they are from all over Ohio State. We have the College of Medicine, Jacob Yant and Stephanie Savo. We have from the vet school, Prosper Boyaka, Estelle Cormet-Boyaka, and Jen Rong Lee. And we have people also from Nationwide Children's Hospital. And they all came along. Just writing the grant and putting it together is a lot of work, but it's so enjoyable because we had fascinating data. And this is what we decided to do together as a group.
I love that. And if you know a fascinating Ohioan that you think should be on our show, you can email allsides@wosu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Instagram. DM us, message us, let us know a fascinating Ohioan that you think whose story we should share. Professor Omer, I have to say, what comes next? Who knows where this is going to take you? But I don't know. What do you think you'll be doing in 5, 10, 15 years?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So as a scientist, you kind of have an expectations. You say, okay, I'm going to do these different experiments. I expect most probably the result will be that way. Maybe it will be a different result. But what's fascinating about science, you can get complete surprise. You can get a result that you never thought of. And I always tell my students when they come back with an expected result, like, Dr. Amer, the experiment didn't work. I got this instead of that. I tell them this is the most fascinating thing. First, let's make sure it's real. But the unexpected result is the discoveries. So what do we expect? We expect that we're going to understand better how SARS-CoV-2 does all the pathologies in the brain and in the lung. And then we can define and design a drug that can target caspase-11, and then we can reduce the symptoms during the acute infection and also what happens after the acute infection in long COVID.
Thanks so much for joining me. That was Amal Amer from Ohio State University.